and welcome to the Leadership Educator Podcast. My name is Dan Jenkins, and I'm Chair and Associate Professor of Leadership and Organizational Studies at the University of Southern Maine.
And I'm Lauren Bullock, Assistant Professor of Instruction at Temple University. And Dan and I are both excited for today's episode of the Leadership Educator Podcast. It seems the theme for 2020 is, one, things aren't going as planned, and two, we have to do these supplemental podcasts to our original plans. So we started the year having great conversations with representatives from different conferences and organizations that we felt leadership educators should attend to develop professionally and connect within the community. Then COVID-19 happened, and we started adding in these episodes around how could leadership educators adjust to COVID-19. And then in the last 2 weeks, we noticed that there was a second need for supplemental episodes, with some centered around race, some centered around civil unrest, and some centered specifically around the Black community. And so today we wanted to add a supplemental episode on top of supplemental episodes on top of our original plan to discuss, you know, what's happening in the United States today. Where I'll start is describing that the incident that is what's become the tipping point for the protests across our country was George Floyd being killed in broad daylight in the middle of the street in Minneapolis. It was recorded and unfortunately streamed over the internet. And as people saw the blatant police brutality, It served as almost a call to action once that video shared. And so what's happening is you're seeing a number of discussions happening around the issues that are plaguing the Black community. And I think at the top of that list is police brutality. So what we decided today was to talk a little bit about, you know, kind of what leadership educators could do, how they could help themselves, how they could help their peers and their students. And so Dan and I have some notes. This is one of those conversations where it's tough to have, but I do think it provides an opportunity to give some guidance. Dan and I have talked about, you know, when things go wrong, people look to the leaders and the leaders should look to leadership educators. And so if we're truly here to serve that purpose, then that's what we're going to talk about. So sound good, Dan?
It does sound good. It is with great leadership comes great responsibility or something to that effect.
Absolutely. So our hope is to talk a little bit about the intersection of leadership and critical race pedagogy, anti-racism, social identities, and then share some steps that leadership educators can take moving forward as we navigate our newest of the new normal situation that's happening. So Dan, you had I don't know who your leader is, but he had the foresight to have your faculty and staff, the common read for this year was anti-racism. And so can you share a little bit about your readings from that book and kind of what you took away from that book?
Certainly. Yeah. And so it's been an interesting journey being, you know, a transplant from Tampa, Florida, which was quite the melting pot, and moving to, you know, the greater Portland area just around 8 years ago. And, you know, we continue to be the second whitest state in the union, thanks to Vermont. And the increase in diversity has come mostly from a large number of immigrants coming from the Sudan and from Somalia and some other African countries. And that has affected the diversity of our greater, you know, Portland area, and certainly the diversity of faculty, staff, and the students at University of Southern Maine. And there have certainly been, we've had our share of challenges and issues in response to some of these changes, both cultural and institutional. And in an effort to respond and be proactive, we had a committee led by our Vice President for Academic Affairs that decided that our common read should be Ibram Kendi's How to Be an Anti-Racist. They certainly had some foresight, it would appear.
Definitely had foresight.
And so as part of that has been a series of lectures and other things, but more recently, right around the turn of the year, of the calendar year, there was an email went out to a select few individuals. I was on that list from our provost that said, hey, you know, you've been identified as someone who might be good to lead a common read discussion on this book. And I had finished the book. I actually did the audible version of it. Ibram has a great speaking voice, and it was a great storyteller. So it was really fun to consume it that way. And these common read discussions. Basically, it was, hey, you know, you're going to attend this workshop or this training, and then in addition, you know, lead some discussions. You get to choose the topic or the lens or the context of which you will, you know, lead these or facilitate these dialogues. And in fact, I proposed it as, well, we're going to talk about leadership and anti-racism, followership and anti-racism, and group dynamics and anti-racism, and how do these, what's the intersectionality here, and how do we, you know, promote or denounce, you know, some of these anti-racist, you know, ideals. And so, it's really been, it was an interesting journey. The trainings were actually very, very good. One of the interesting things about that process too, though, was that the two facilitators teaching us, you know, how to lead these discussions were two white women. And so, you know, and there were also very few people of color that were also being trained as mm-hmm. part of the group. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we did learn a lot of really, really good techniques for facilitating dialogue. In the middle of it all, I think it was maybe 4 or 5 days before I was going to start these common reads discussion groups, COVID happened. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we ended up on Zoom, which actually didn't, you know, while the numbers went down, fewer people than signed up participated, but ended up being one of the few discussion groups that actually continued, and I was willing to facilitate these conversations via Zoom. So that happened. You know, it's interesting because a lot of what Abram talks about in the text are things that are very foreign to individuals who have lived in some place that does not have a lot of diversity. It's hard to understand some of the examples of racist policies if you know, these policies have created because there were not others that were not like the majority. The majority was such a majority that policies just seemed like, oh, well, this is how we should do things. You know, one of the interesting things that happened very, very recently in response to what happened to George Floyd was we got a message from our chancellor's office. So we, like many university systems, have a board of trustees, and there's an appointed chancellor that leads that group. And instead of simply denouncing the murder of George Floyd, instead, the statement from our chancellor's office was identifying all of the racist policies that we had in place within our university system, and was addressing responses to be proactive to look into those, such as not having any non-white members of the board of trustees as just one, and looking at, were there any racist policies with respect to admissions and other types of things throughout the university system, just to start. And so I'm not going to go into the long memo that was sent out, but it was really interesting to see that, and I'm hopeful that members of our university, you know, responded to that in a way that perhaps they may not have previously to having participated in this common read and been part of these conversations.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I almost feel like crowning whoever the person behind this is leader of the year in the unofficial The Leadership Educator Podcast right. Awards, simply because to have that amazing foresight, to have those that interacted with a small population of Black students and professionals read such a profound book that now you can't get anywhere. It's sold out on Amazon, print copies, as well as there's a 6 to 12 month waiting list to just get it through your library systems. To have that foresight to know that now is a time when we need to focus on this issue is amazing. In addition, applauding those that signed up, I think part of the challenge, at least I've seen in the years I've had this conversation or been involved in conversations around like diversity and equity and inclusion, is centered around people just sitting down to have the discussion and admitting that they may or may not know or need to learn. And I think that is that first step. I had a conversation with one of our diversity and inclusion people at Temple, because even though, like, you know, I've gone through graduate courses in it, I have a graduate certificate in diversity leadership, even I still feel like I need to learn more, because the construct, the topic is just changing as we learn more about the differences that we share. And so just having that program at your university is great. In addition to the chancellor, not just saying, you know, we stand with the community, it's here's what we're going to do, so that people can hold them accountable. In our conversation, Dan, I mentioned it too, when we talk about gun control in our country and people get mad when people say, oh, our thoughts and prayers are with you. And it's like, no, we don't want thoughts and prayers. We want legislation and we want policy change. And I think at the root of all of this is policy change. I think back to, and it was either Breonna Taylor or it was George Floyd. The officers in that case were fired because they violated a policy of not turning on their camera. So they weren't fired because of the national attention. They were fired because they failed to follow a policy, and that policy was changed in 2016 as a result of local advocacy efforts. And so, you know, we in leadership talk a lot about advocacy, and we teach students about being involved and being civic leaders. And it was the leaders in that space that changed that policy to at least in the short term, feel like George Floyd's family got a little bit of justice. I think about it, my own university, we used to have the nomer, we used to be called Diversity University. I don't know who gave us that tag. I don't know the origin of it, but the thing that I felt that was truly attached to our culture was the fact that you could be in this space with, you were going to engage with people who didn't have the same background as you did in a lot of your classes. And I know when I teach, I do a whole lesson in my groups and teams class on diversity. And I have my students like, tell me how you're different. And they're like, well, no, we all look this one way. And then when we really get into discussing some of the different characteristics, the demographic, the organizational, and the psychological characteristics related to diversity, we then get into a deeper conversation. And often they respond like, you know, I didn't think about that. Like, I didn't think that me being first generation mattered. I didn't think that because I'm an adult student, I would have this diverse perspective. And so often, like, part of where we need to start is just being comfortable with facilitating that dialogue. I also think too, what's happening now makes us as leadership educators even more accountable. You know what I mean? Like, we had conversations around like, kind of what leadership theories apply, or what do we see in action, or what works best? Like, I know I brought up authentic leadership. So we're looking at the values of those that are in place, and are they aligned with our values, and are we going to follow them? And as such, and also this moral component, like, are our leaders doing what we feel is morally right? What else do you think about in terms of leadership theory and this, and what's happening now in terms of the civil unrest and or what's happening in the Black community?
Sure. You know, I think that, you know, one of the other theories that we talked about was, you know, relational leadership. And, you know, mm-hmm. I'm thinking specifically the relational leadership model that we utilize in student leadership development theory from the Comevis Lucas and McMahon text, the Exploring Leadership for College Students Who Want to Make a Difference, where they define it as, you know, people coming together to accomplish positive change, you know, through this relational and ethical model. And so the positive change that we're all coming together to affect is this movement that we're seeing across the globe. You know, one of the best headlines I've ever seen, I don't know why it just hit me so hard yesterday. I was on, you know, it was a CNN headline. They were talking about the statue of the slave owner that came down in Great Britain. And it says, you know, this statue comes down as anti-racist rallies and demonstrations span the globe, or something like that, mm-hmm. or global anti-racist rallies continue, or something to that effect. And I was thinking to myself, this is different. You know, mm-hmm. I think the only demonstrations of this level that I can remember from history have been anti-war demonstrations, at least in the United States. You mm-hmm. know, certainly mm-hmm. in other parts of the globe, you may have seen, you know, responses to the apartheid in South Africa, for example, or, you know, responses in Europe to the rise of Nazism or something to that effect. But to see these anti-racist rallies and the diversity of individuals coming together is really fantastic and, mm-hmm. and different and unique and perhaps one of its kind. And so you have this authentic movement that is of people coming together to do this work, to organize this work. Mm-hmm. You know, I think mm-hmm. that's where some of the leadership education lens comes in, is, you know, not only do individuals look to us for, well, how do we do this? How do we organize? How do we stay ethical in our approaches? And then, you know, oftentimes we're also called upon to facilitate dialogue around these issues. Mm-hmm, and so, mm-hmm. you know, you mentioned before, Lauren, hey, it's okay not to know what to do. It's okay not to know what to say. Mm-hmm, but some mm-hmm. of those skills just fall under, can you facilitate a healthy dialogue? And can you do so by putting us in a into a state of mind where we can share some of those differences that we have. And so that was definitely part of the training that we had for facilitating these common reads discussions was around, let's have a conversation about the multiple identities and social identities that we hold, everything mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. race to background to, you know, do you have a, you know, to disability, to demographic, and, mm-hmm. you know, how well off were your parents, and where are you from, and do you speak any other languages? And you know, there's so many levels of identity, and that does open the door to, you know, getting beyond just the human condition where, you know, mm-hmm. I think I remember reading somewhere from a an evolutionary biologist, you know, that said, you know, the first two things that we realize when we run into another human being is, you know, is that person male or female? And then what color is their skin? And mm-hmm. how does that, you know, is it different than mine? You know, mm-hmm. and that's just the mm-hmm. human condition. And yeah. so if that's all we have, like you're not even at the starting line.
Yeah. It's so interesting you say that. I taught because it's summertime in faculty life, your days start to blend together when you don't have assigned course days. And so in the last 2 weeks, I led a workshop for our business school and their women's leadership program. And I said to them, it was on managing team diversity. And I said, you know, your natural reaction is to categorize people and you look physical before that person even opens their mouth. And, you know, and that's okay. That's a natural reaction. You're not going to change. What's not okay are the assumptions that you make as a result of those cues. And for you, it's really being humble and curious about to learn about that individual and throwing away kind of what you know that doesn't serve you and really focusing on getting to know that person. Like, for example, when I identify as African American and my students, when we play this game, truth, truth, lie, one of my statements is always I'm fourth generation college student. And they're like, oh no, that's the lie. Let's toss that out there. And I'm like, nope. My great grandmother graduated from Rutgers with an accounting degree. My grandmother has a degree in education from Keene. My dad graduated from NJIT and I graduated from Temple University in Philadelphia. And it's just because they assume that I'm a person of color, I can't be. And all of those folks that I mentioned are also Black people as well. And so it's fine if you first notice those physical cues. It's okay if you see a person's color. It's fine. What's not okay is ignoring that person's color or applying those or assuming, making assumptions about what you see. And I think those are the conversations that we need to have. I also think what I've learned, if nothing, is our young people get it. Like I talk to my students and they're like, this is stupid. What should I do? You know, they're really like up in arms and I love it. And it makes me feel like I've got to do a better job to make sure I equip them with the tools that they need to navigate it. I am a huge sports fan and I was listening to Steve Kerr, Greg Popovich, and he's the Seattle Seahawks coach, Pete Carroll. Right. And Pop said, and I love Pop, even though I'm a Brooklyn Nets fan, I love Pop and the Spurs, but he said that we've got to teach people the entirety of our history in this country, as well as equip them with tools so they can navigate it. And I think where we failed at it as adults is truly equipping them with the tools that they need to navigate, not just, you know, Black issues, but all kinds of issues. I mean, climate change, all kinds of issues that we're seeing now. And I think that's our commitment as leadership educators. And I think it's less a morality is important, but morality is going to change. But it's more or less like, can we teach them how to identify what's right and what's good and what's best for those in this space, and then teach them how they can actually enact change? I think that's what we're focused on.
I think that's right. And part of it is because discussion is our primary, you know, instructional strategy. It's our signature pedagogy for leadership. And I think the reason for that is that talking helps people, you know, we need that dialogue and we need it, you know, in whatever format that we can deliver it, we've been forced to Zoom. I mean, perhaps that's another reason why these protests people have been coming out in numbers like we've never seen before, is because people are like, oh, well, we can come out together for this. we've been quarantined for 3 months, but Hey, this sounds, you know, and I'm not minimizing the cause at any rate at all. Perhaps this is, you know, the timing of this, things happen for a reason, you know, perhaps, mm-hmm, hey, 2020, mm-hmm. like, all right, like we're going to keep taking shots, but you know what? No, now we're going to come back, and you know, and here's why, you know, and I think that, as you mentioned about equipping, you know, individuals to have the tools to navigate this, I think that that's where that dialogue is so important, is it gives students, again, individuals, the opportunity to have those conversations, to learn about, you know, to make sense of the situations. And then, you know, it's Kolb's learning cycle, to go back out and experiment and let me interact with this friend or this family member, or, and try to have this conversation again. And hopefully I'm navigating it with a little bit more capacity than I was before, so that I can help to facilitate this positive change as well.
Yeah, I love that. It reminds me of, it reminds me of an old saying that I have. I tell my students to find their people, meaning Temple is a large university. It's 37,000 students, 4,000 faculty, staff, administrators. It's huge. And you don't have to know everybody, but you do have to know and maybe find your people. And now I'll add path, because once you find those people, it is important for you to advocate however you see fit, you know, as you all walk along this shared path towards, you know, moving forward. And I love that you're right, like discussion is crucial. But I think what feels different right now, and we've talked about this, is that people are now putting action and expectations to, you know, what they discuss. So as we as leadership educators are facilitating these, are we asking people like, what one thing can you do? And are we creating this culture of accountability? So I know for me, I found this really great article, and it was like it was 75 things that white people could do to help this cause. And I was like, you know, that's wonderful, but these ideas are good for everybody. Like one of the suggestions was, you know, calling your local police department and asking if there was a law or policy around body cams. And if there was, thank your legislators or thank whoever put that policy in place. And if there wasn't, then, you know, start writing letters and advocate for that, because that's what's saving a lot of people's lives, and that's what's changing policy. It was labeled as 75 things white people could do, but I felt like it was just tangible, clear strategies that you can enact no matter what your background was. I think the other thing that I noticed in this last 2 weeks is we have to really appreciate, and I appreciate this as a leadership educator, we have to start valuing people more. So instead of prioritizing tasks and work, and just like you mentioned, relational leadership, this shift is monumentally about how are we appreciating people, and how are we seeing past those visible physical cues and really looking at who they are and what makes them up as a person. And I think that's our biggest task moving forward. And I think that's what's going to push this, like as we've moved into transformational theory, I think that's going to push this to an even greater stead. If we can get leaders to care more about people than they do about productivity and invest in it, because that's the way to increase your productivity, I think that's going to be huge. Unfortunately, I don't think we're there. Like over the last couple of weeks, I've talked to friends, and I had a friend who, you know, she was on a work meeting and somebody joked about the looting, you know, in their conference call. And then, you know, I talked to someone else, and with all that's going on, their superiors, their supervisors dumping more work on them and not even acknowledging that they may have some trauma based on what we're seeing in this community. So I appreciate that it's eye-opening, but I also think we've got so far to go in terms of really getting our leaders to care. I think it's one thing young people in this generation, they do really well. They care so much about other people. Like I joke in my class, when I have them give peer feedback, they don't want to say anything hurtful. And I'm like, well, think about it like this. If they're going out to the club on Friday night, are you going to let them walk out in that tacky dress or those terrible shoes or the dirty shirt? No, you're going to gently pull them to the side and say, I know that's what you want, but maybe you should try this. Or, hey, I've got a great shirt for you. The same approach you use to talking to them about this, use it to talk to them about their skills and what they need to develop in the conversations that they need to have. It should be put in the show notes somewhere that humor is one of my values. So as we're having this discussion, that's where my advice, I try and be relatable. That's where my advice comes from.
Oh, I think that's great. And one of the things that really spoke to me that you were sharing was something about this, repurposed or like rejuvenated, just intent to to take action and to and to be an activist, just to go out and, you know, demonstrate and to activate, you know. And I remember some of the early scholarship that I read on, you know, critical thinking, and, you know, there's some terminology around critical leadership and, you know, and leading critically. And part of it, you know, stemmed from the difference between critical thinking and critical leadership being, you know, this requires action, not just thought, you know? And so again, timing is everything. And so, and timing is everything with respect to comedy too. So you'll like that, Lauren. so people have just been sitting around like, you're just thinking about this stuff. You're listening, you're watching. I mean, we're being exposed to so much more media and social media because we're stir crazy and we're quarantined. And so we're being shot out of cannons to these rallies and these demonstrations. I mean, even in the small town that I live in, just north of Portland, Maine, Brunswick, Maine, about 30,000 residents. I mean, there was a good number of individuals that have been doing activism and holding rallies in front of our police station. It's real, you know, it's in scale, you know, you know, same thing in Augusta, there were thousands, and that might not seem like a lot, but that's a lot in Augusta.
Well, there are cities where they're stopping traffic on the major highways, like I-95, poor I-95, they've had stops all, like I know, and I live in Delaware, and they shut down the highway twice over the weekend because of protesters who were peacefully demonstrating on the highway. But in this, from my communications background, there's two theories that apply to what we're seeing now. First one is called social network theory. And in social network theory, and this is where the crux of the Black Lives Matter, this is where the crux of the success comes from for Black Lives Matter, is that people who can't protest can still get on Facebook or get on Twitter or get on some social media platform and voice their opinion. And as a result, organizations have to pay attention. So like right now, like Tuesday, we had the Blackout Tuesday, or people were looking at their timeline. They were looking at the organizations and what they said. I think Matthew Cherry posted like this template, and it's like, dear brand, I stand with Black community, this brand. And it was all this templated words, and people were double checking Matthew Cherry's brand template with what, you know, their favorite organizations are saying. And so again, it's like people are really using social media and using the power of the relationships that they had to move this cause forward. And I think the other thing we have to consider is something called agenda setting theory. And in public relations and communication, it ultimately, what it says is the media controls what we think about. And so if you're constantly seeing 10 different versions of a COVID-19 case, and if this new break is civil unrest or protest, you're going to see 10 different protest case, and you're going to see like a positive and a negative and a local. And so it's like, it's also being mindful of what we're consuming, how we're processing it, and then how is that impacting what we see. And one of my best friends, she lives out in LA, and she was headed out to a protest. And, you know, she was saying they've been largely peaceful. She had been out protesting for days, and they had been largely peaceful. I was like, that's interesting, because I was up watching CBS News LA. I happened to get it in my house. The internet. But I was watching it, and all they showed was like massive arrests and destruction. And I was like, you know, it's interesting the different narratives that are being painted. But again, one of the things we have to be mindful of as we're thinking critically or thinking and processing the information that we're consuming, it's really thinking about, you know, where are we getting it? Is it credible? And how are we working with that information? So yeah, I don't know if you have anything else to say, but I feel like we've done a really good job of at least initially having this discussion so that we could get out there in our community and lend our voices to this space. I don't know if you have any wrap-up thoughts.
Well, I think just that part of our responsibility of leadership educators is to be there to listen. You know, we had Carrie Priest on our podcast very recently, and I was on a meeting with her and some other individuals across the, you know, leadership education from around the world. And, you know, we before jumping into like the business of the day, Carrie said, "Hey, you know, like, how's everybody doing? Like, let's just take some time to talk about that." And I later said, "I'm so glad that you asked that question." And there were 10 of us, and we all went around and we shared, and, you know, people are dealing with all kinds of things. I mean, we're individuals from Australia, from Canada, from all over the U.S. And it really did bring us closer together. It goes back to that conversation we had before about it's not just the different social identities we have, but it's the different experiences and the different ways that we're experiencing everything that's going on right now. So be humble, be curious, listen, provide those opportunities for these things to happen. And a lot of that is the responsibility that we have as leadership educators, and to empower those individuals that trust us to model that behavior, to give them some skills and develop their capacities to equip them to be a little bit better off navigating that on their own and with their organizations and friends and families.
Yeah, what an important statement to make. So with that, we conclude today's episode of the Leadership Educator Podcast.
We hope you enjoyed listening at home or walking your dog or engaging in another activity where you are practicing social distancing.
We are the gurus of social distance podcasting, as we are separated by 6 states, more than the CDC required 6 feet.
Well, that is what we do. So way to be a leader in that area. So jokes aside, thank you for joining us today. We invite you to follow us on Twitter. I am at @Dr_leadership. And Lauren is at @MrsLaurjb. That's Miss Laura JB. We want to encourage you to listen to the full episodes as they are released, as we can only share a fraction of the amazing stories that our guests shared. You can find the episodes wherever podcasts are available. And we also encourage you to rate us 5 stars, as the more you rate us, the easier it is for others to find us.
We'd also like to thank the James M. Cox Jr. Institute for Journalism, Innovation, Management, and Leadership within the Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication at the University of Georgia. The support was facilitated by Dr. Keith Herndon, William S. Morris Chair in New Strategy and Management.
That's right. And our wonderful theme music was composed, performed, and mixed by Dr. Matthew White, trumpeter, composer, and educator. And he's currently the associate professor of trumpet, coordinator of jazz and commercial music, and director of ensembles at Coastal Carolina University. He's also a Guggenheim Fellow, some new news. You can check him out, yeah, at www.mattwhitejazz.com. Matt, thank you so much for sharing your musical genius with our audience. And finally, thank you to the Association of Leadership Educators. Check out what the ALE has to offer at leadershipeducators.org. And we hope you will listen to our next episode wherever you get your podcasts.